Welcome back, folks. It's Mark Steiner. Now, every Friday, we hear a commentary from Kole Tengela about our world. He's the president of Tengela Edutainment, where he uses theater, film, and new media for positive social change. He's an instructor and creator of the Positive Social Change Theater Performing Arts Program at the Augusta Fell Savage Institute for Visual Arts, a high school in our community. He was also an Open Society Fellow. And here's Tengela's take.
Saying Black Lives Matters as a TV or radio news soundbite, a phrase on a T-shirt, or a sign held over the head of an intense-looking protester seemed to be cool and palatable for white America. But now that the Black Lives Matters movement is taking it straight to the white political structures and presidential candidates, the mess is starting to get real. It's not only getting real for white America that seems to be utterly shocked that black African folk believe that our lives are important enough to move beyond cute slogans and T-shirts to disrupting white political and social life by demanding an end to the nearly wholesale societal acceptance of the killing and murdering of black people. Because, good people, that is what you do when your life is at stake. You demand. You fight. White America seems to be upset that we would dare disrupt your commute to work or a white person's speech who wants to be president. It is no comparison to the level of upset I feel when I see and hear about another African black person senselessly murdered by another so-called human being who is supposed to protect them. It appears, white America, what you are saying is what really matters is white life, white political empowerment, and control. Please don't take your complaints about your rampant slaughter above the level of a T-shirt, and don't jam up my commute. And the black folks who view Black Lives Matter as just another useless protest that won't change anything, I say this to you all. Stop it. Get a spine and some self-worth. You African black folk who think that are probably the same black people that believe that if we speak the truth about how we feel about our situation in this country, that white people will get angry and that they have magical powers to get revenge. Like a black person will wake up the next day, our credit and bank cards won't work, we will be evicted from our apartment, our health insurance will be gone. Well, they're trying to appeal Obamacare, maybe they do have superpowers to jack up your life. And one other thing. Why do we, as black people, feel that we need to whisper every time we are talking among ourselves about the incorrect and racist treatment we get from white society, even when there are no white people around? What's up with that? What the Black Lives Matter movement is about the deconstructing, breaking down of white supremacist infrastructure that perpetuates the idea that the life of African black folk is less valuable than those of white people. I've become less optimistic about changing hearts and minds, but what I believe we all can do as good-hearted and correct citizens of this planet, when it comes to the treatment of those who are not white, people of color, in particularly black African folk, is change the rules of engagement where black lives truly do matter. My name's Kole Tengela, and that's my take.
Thank you, Kole Tengela, for that commentary. You can hear Kole every Friday at 10 on The Mark Steiner Show. And you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're about to have a conversation with Wendell Pierce. Many of you listening in Baltimore and everywhere know him as Bunk in The Wire. He was in Treme, two HBO dramas. You saw him in Selma, Ray, Waiting to Exhale, excuse me, and has been doing incredible work and is a Tony Award winner for Clybourne Park, which played here in Baltimore recently, and is host of the Jazz at Lincoln Center, which is very cool as well, and has written this book, The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. And Wendell, good to have you back on The Steiner Show.
Oh, it's great to be on The Steiner Show.
How are you, man?
This is one of my favorites. I'm doing great. It's good to be back with you. It always reminds me of how much I love Baltimore, and it's like a second home, you know. So when I come on the show, I'm transported back to my home.
Good.
My second home.
That's good. And your first home is what we're talking about, which is New Orleans in this book. I've seen and heard other people talk about this book, and but one of the things that's striking about this book is, more than anything, and it's important, I think we will talk about Godot and the rest and Pontchartrain. It's also about New Orleans, about black family,
yes,
and culture, about the future post-Katrina that's kind of tied to these deep historical roots of a city to slavery resistance up until now and the future. It's about you, but it's you that couldn't be you without all that.
Yeah, it's an absolute fact that I am the man I am today because of the culture and the people and existence and this legacy that was passed on to me. The reason I wrote the book is it was because it was an awakening for me. It was a realization that, one, that art is powerful, is transformative. It is insurrection. It is reformation. That also recognizing that power of the art and culture, I realized that I am from a place, New Orleans, where we live our culture more than most places in the world, most places I've visited especially. And the role of culture is something that is slipping away. Art and culture is the forum where we reflect on who we are as a people. It's what thoughts are to the individual when they're lying awake at night and they're trying to figure out who they are, where they've come from, where they've failed, where they've triumphed. What sort of person that they want to become, what those thoughts are to the individual, the forum of art is the place where we collectively come together as a society, as a community, and reflect on who we are, where we've been, what our hopes are, where our triumphs, our failures are, and the society that we want to be. We declare our values, and then we act on them. That's the role of art. Entertainment is just a residual of it.
Right.
It is not the sole purpose of it. Art is not arbitrary. It's active. And we understood that in New Orleans and understand it to this day. Our art and culture was always something that was practical, tangible, useful. Social aid and pleasure clubs where you have the second line. It was because black folks were in an ugly time and segregation not allowed access to health care and to burial plots and redlined by insurance companies. So they pooled together their money in social aid and pleasure clubs. We understand the pleasure part. You know what a second line is. You know how to have a good time, party, parade, good music. But the social aid and that social safety net is what we forget about. Your mama takes sick, Mark? Here's a little something. Your daddy dies, we're going to send him off nice with a jazz funeral, in the respect and the need, in the way that he needs to be remembered. And we'll buy the burial plot. We'll take care of the funeral because you've pooled your money in this grassroots benevolent association. It goes back even further than that. These captured Africans in Congo Square as slaves on Sunday allowed to be unshackled for the first time and to play the bambula and dance the bambula. Right, that African six, right, and they hear the music of their European captors, oom-pa-pa, and they merge them together and create the greatest American aesthetically beautiful piece of art, and this art form is created, jazz, jazz. They found their expressive creative freedom before they even found their physical one. It was the seeds of insurrection. It was the fuel that they needed to reflect on their situation and figure out a way to get out of it. And even more practical than that, in Congo Square, you had free people of color who had just come from Haiti, who had done it already. So they were even able to get guidance from them. It's like, how are we going to get out of the situation that we're in? How do we find a way to rise up? and let's declare our insurrection. And in that group of people there at the beginning of jazz is who? Paul Levine and Homer Plessy, that we all know from, yes, Plessy versus Ferguson.
Right.
The seeds of the modern day civil rights movement there, created with the music. So our culture has always been the incubator of action, insurrection, reformation, reclamation, rejuvenation, and resilience in New Orleans. And I saw that when I did a play after Katrina. I was reminded of that power, and that play was Waiting for Godot.
Waiting for Godot, because you heard about what happened in Baltimore with the uprising around Freddie Gray's death. And
absolutely.
One thing I said to my producers today, actually, in thinking about us having this conversation, was that we need to put Waiting for Godot on in the streets here for the same reason, right? Because how it speaks.
Desolation, where are we? What defines us? Who are we? Are we looking for that power outside of ourselves? What is this entity that we are waiting for? But ultimately, the realization is the power within you that the two characters discover. The power of exercising the right of self-determination. And that's the thing that had great, you know, resonance in New Orleans, that in spite of all that is not happening, you have a power within you to change the direction and change all of the obstacles and things placed in front of you and define who you are. And that was the thing that spoke to me in the play. And in the Lower Ninth Ward, where we did it, where miles around was destruction. We were on hallowed ground where so many people had lost their lives. And as a New Orleanian, I stepped out of character, really, almost in the middle of the play, and had one of the most cathartic moments of my life when I said, let us do something while we have the chance. In this place, in this moment of time, all mankind is us, whether we like it or not. Let us do something before it's too late. And that call of action, call to action, of self-reliance, of understanding that if you can't wait for an entity that's not coming, that has disappointed you before, just spoke to all New Orleanians that night in a way that I had never experienced in my work before. And it was a call to action, and it was what art is supposed to do in that forum, define who we are and define what the values are and act on them.
So you didn't expect that performance to be as cathartic or as life-changing for you as it was when you did that performance, did you?
No, I mean, Waiting for Godot is such a difficult play.
It's not easy to do.
You know, surrealistic play about two bums in a void with only a road and a tree who don't know who they are, what they're doing, where they're going. They're waiting for Godot, but they don't know who Godot is, what it is, whatever. It's a very difficult play to do, but what happens is, if done properly, it speaks to your humanity in a way that makes it classic. What makes something classic is something that speaks to humanity across time, across space and generation, you know, written in a time of occupation under the Nazis. Beckett writes a play that will speak to human beings for time to come. In the 1980s, Susan Sontag did a famous production of it in Sarajevo. In the midst of the violence and destruction and hopelessness there, that you find that seed to go on, to find the seed to survive all of this that is placed upon you that can be self-destructive. But ultimately, you have to find self-affirmation. And then it speaks to the people of New Orleans in the midst of this death and destruction in New Orleans, where people realize the resonance of that play so immediately. When we did it in Harlem, at the Classical Theater of Harlem,
right,
we had a stage of 15,000 gallons of water. Estragon is sitting on the rooftop coming out of that water, and I make an entrance wading through the flood. No one had to say a word. They knew it was New Orleans. We didn't have to change a single line in the play. That image was so clear because we had seen those images on television. And in the media. And so to do it in West Baltimore amongst those abandoned row houses
right.
would speak volumes also. But it just shows you how a piece of art can be of great importance. I think what we created with The Wire was a piece of art. And if anything, what was on display is how important a piece of art can be. Last year during the uprising, people didn't want to first think about it, but they had to realize that there was a cultural examination of all the variables that caused the uprising for 5 years on our show. And they are examining it in universities across this country, and at Harvard and Berkeley and at Duke and at Tulane, courses at Howard Law School about it. People making a determination and understanding how to deal with public policy by looking at episodes of The Wire, understanding police brutality by looking at episodes of The Wire, never looking at a corner boy again the same way, because you saw the humanity that we gave them in The Wire, and understanding that all of the socialized ingredients that created these young men who are going to an underground economy because they are not a part of our regular economy, because the schools are so dysfunctional, and an examination of that. We gave you a cultural syllabus of things to look at and understand the debate that has to go on when the uprising in Baltimore happened, because we have been bringing it to the attention of viewers for years in the forum of art, holding, as it were, a mirror up to nature.
I mean, what you describe as art, what you describe in the book as your approach to theater and art is very powerful, because people see you in your iconic role as Bunk and see you as Wendell Pierce, the actor up on stage or on the big screen or on television. But that's Wendell Pierce, the great actor, but also the good businessman and actor who's out there, but not what fuels you or what you think fuels where you are or fuels why you went to Juilliard in the first place.
We've gotten away from what is the role of art, and that's why people don't see it or say people were uncomfortable about bringing up Wire or talking to cast members or writers from the show about the uprising. Wait, that's pretend. You know, this is the real deal. You know, we're talking about serious things here. And I said, but this is the forum in which you talk about serious things. This is the realm. This is where you deal with it. The art is the delivery system of those systems. You can have great art. The merger of technical proficiency and individual expression and creativity, the merger of those two is high art. And in all of its glory, you can have high art in all your different disciplines. There's great art in politics. There's great art in city planning. There's great art in philosophy. There's great art in policing. There's great art in whatever endeavor you have, because it's about technical proficiency, merging with expressive thought, coexisting. It's ultimately the greatest example of the American aesthetic, freedom within form. A jazz musician honors the form of a tune, but with his solo, he can go anywhere he wants to go, be as expressive as he can be, but still honor the form of the tune. An infinite amount of combination of those notes with a finite number of notes. That's what high art is. The Impressionists of the late 19th century were considered crazy because they had those just wild brushstrokes of paint just thrown on the canvas. Mm-hmm. And then people took 10 feet back, they stepped back and realized, oh my goodness, what I thought was haphazard with no direction, right? Just uninhibited paint thrown at the canvas is actually has formed into the image of the haystacks and the snow and Giverny, or the lily pond that Manet made so famous, and Renoir's landscapes of Paris. Then you start to realize, oh my goodness, there's freedom within the form. They've honored the image and the form, but they still had their own individuality. That is the American aesthetic that we put into our government, into our Constitution. We're going to find a way that you can be an individual and free and creative, and at the same time, you're going to be able to be a land governed by laws. That's what the Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs are about. Right. I saw that in my communities in New Orleans, and that was so much a part of my DNA. That informs my work, and that's when the work is the best and when it is of great importance. The music of Woody Guthrie during the Great Depression,
right.
This land is your land, this land is my land, giving people hope in a time of hopelessness. I would say someone I don't even agree with politically found the aspirational message that touched people's humanity, an artistic act in the boundaries of politics. It's Morning in America.
Mm.
Ronald Reagan.
Right. Right.
Right.
Right.
Every New Orleanian can tell you where they were when they heard after Katrina Louis Armstrong saying, "Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans and miss her each night and day?" That refrain was haunting. My God, I may never see my city again. It is destroyed. So the power of art is aspirational. It's insurrection. It's a call to the human spirit to declare what is valuable to you and act on it.
And because you had that sense of what the power of art is and the fact that you are a son and child of New Orleans and love the place you're in and love the family and culture and place that spawned you, that's why you exploded artistically to take on this task of rebuilding Pontchartrain and rebuilding a community that had been devastated. That
yes.
was almost, when people told me you started that, I said, whoa, that's huge. I mean, but many people probably thought you were out of your mind. Right?
Right. But you know something? I had a great responsibility because a part of my awakening was realizing that this great Moses generation had passed on a responsibility and a legacy to me as a Joshua, part of the Joshua generation. Pontchartrain Park is a historic neighborhood that came out of post-World War II suburbia in a time of segregation in New Orleans when black people could not purchase a house anywhere they wanted to. A.P. Turow, a great civil rights lawyer in New Orleans, started the advocacy to have access to green space because you could only go to a park in New Orleans on Wednesdays.
If you were black.
If you were black in Jim Crow New Orleans, segregation. So to fight that, the advocacy started so we could have access to green space. That movement was so strong and started to have some impact that they did a set-aside, an appeasement. Here's 200 acres. 1,000 homes around a golf course designed by Joseph Bartholomew, a black man who was a landscape architect who designed most of the courses in New Orleans, but because he was black, he couldn't play on them.
Mm-mm.
Used to walk the course at night as he designed them to see if his design was working, because if he was caught on the course during the day, he would be arrested.
Mm.
That was Pontchartrain Park. Separate but equal, separated by a ditch between our neighborhood and the neighboring white neighborhood. So we decided to take something ugly, separate but equal, and make it beautiful. It became an incubator for talent. The first black mayor came out of Pontchartrain Park, Dutch Morial, his son, Mark Morial, who was mayor and is now national president of the Urban League, Lisa Jackson, who I grew up with, who was the EPA director in the Obama administration, Terrence Blanchard, who was the great jazz composer and musician, composing music for the Spike Lee films. And these are the people that came out of Pontchartrain Park. What Baldwin Hills is to Los Angeles, or Sweet Auburn was to Atlanta, an incubator of black talent across the board. And this was what we had fought for and built, and it was at some of the deepest part of the flooding. It would have been blasphemous for my generation to sit back and let it go. As my parents die off, as our elders die off, because too many people fought and sacrificed so much in that great American movement of equality in the mid-20th century that we recognize as the Civil Rights Movement. There's blood on that ballot box. People died. If we're going to honor those who lost their lives for American values in foreign wars, we're going to honor those who lost their lives on domestic shores, on dirt roads, in creeks, lynched from trees, at the barrel of a gun of another American. Those souls that spoke to me when I was in Selma shooting a film, the last moment I remember was standing on the Edmund Pettus Bridge looking in the Alabama River, and all I could hear was Don't let them forget me, Wendell. Tell our story. That is the call to action. That after the play, I said, I have to make sure my neighborhood comes back. So we put together our own development corporation, exercised our right of self-determination, negotiated with the government to get those properties that were sold back in the Road Home program so we can put houses on them. And brick by brick, house by house, block by block, we brought Pontchartrain Park back.
And your parents were the first ones to move back into their home, right? In that neighborhood.
One of the first. Yes, one of the first. I actually got really scared because they were like one of maybe two families on their block. You know, it was real scattered. I actually asked the police to put them on their ride report and let them know that there's actually somebody who lives in this house. So it was something that a mission that I gave myself. I said, my parents were in their 70s and 80s, and I said, I want to make sure that I get them back in that house before they die. I didn't share it with them, but that was what I had in my heart and the thing that helped me get up every morning to make sure I got them back was I said, if they walk in and fall dead that very minute, I know I will have achieved what was important to me. They worked too hard and sacrificed too much to lose it overnight with these failed levees. So I said, whatever I do, I'm going to get them back in their house before they die. And I was able to achieve that.
You were able to achieve that. And in the face of this, there's so much of this book I could quote to you. But as we spend the rest of the time together, part of it, I'm going to throw this out to you here. Because when you told that story, there's a man you write about in this book whose name was Jimmy Reese.
Yes.
Right? And the quote you have here is that he made this quote in the Wall Street Journal after Katrina. Talking about the future of New
Orleans. 1 week.
1 week. And coming from an old, white, wealthy family, rich and politically well-connected, as you wrote. The quote was, those who want to see this city rebuilt want to see it done in a completely different way, demographically, geographically, and politically. I'm not just speaking for myself here. The way we've been living is not going to happen again, or we're out.
So absolutely.
His vision, that vision is different than the one you're talking about.
Absolutely. And the one thing that I learned, this awakening, which is what this book is about, a snapshot of an awakening that happened to me as an artist, that then happened to me as a citizen, that happened to me as a member of a community with a great legacy of fighting those who do not have our best interest at heart. That's how my grandparents and parents chose to describe what was a violent, racist, prejudiced world of white supremacy, of elitism, of classism. There are those who don't have your best interest at heart. Mm-hmm. A wonderful description, because what happens is it doesn't put it on any one person or variable. Or anybody could be one of that number, those who don't have your best interest at heart. But they say when they declare who they are, then you know. Then you are clear about where they stand when it comes to you. Jimmy Reese, Andrew O'Dwyer, mm-hmm. another, who said it was the best thing that ever happened to New Orleans. The article is September 8th, 2005, for those of you who want to Google it. You knew right away, while people were still drowning, they were saying, we're going to change the city. We're going to get rid of the people we don't want. And when evil people plot, good people have to plan. Because what they did was take what their agenda was and put it into policy. Jimmy Reese was on the Bring Back New Orleans Commission, where they've printed on the front page of the Times-Picayune communities that they said should just go back to nature. Mm. Let them just be expropriated by swampland. Just let them be taken over once again and turn into just green space. And tried to give that idea that it would be a beautiful bucolic image of the city going back to its natural habitat. And they put green dots on the map over neighborhoods and printed it on the front page of the paper. And this is the Bring Back New Orleans plan, the most ironic of names. The Bring Back New Orleans plan was to let New Orleans go away. And people saw those green dots over their neighborhood and realized, oh, my goodness, they are coming for us.
Right.
And they put it into policy. Now, we have lost 100,000 poor African-American people because the one thing they did on scale after Katrina was not build, but actually demolish. They took out all public housing. All public housing. Did they bring it back one for one? No, because that doesn't fit the plan. The plan was to get rid of people. We're going to change it demographically, geographically, and politically, or we're out of here. He said it. They said what they were going to do. And now, 10 years later, as I launched this book in New Orleans at the Carver Theater across from the Lafitte Housing Project, which was one of the large, the big four, as they call them, public housing, they were just framing up some of the public housing 10 years after the fact. Now, they know those people aren't coming back. That's called dismemberment. That's called disbursement by delay.
Mm-hmm.
You get rid of people that way. You don't have to say, I'm going to get rid of you. You just take 10 years to rebuild a house. The person that was living in that house is somewhere else right now. They're in Memphis or they're in Atlanta. They threw down just a seed that's now grown into a tree. They're not going to uproot themselves from wherever they are. We're going to get rid of the people we don't want. We're going to change this city demographically, geographically, and politically, or we're out of here. They stated their case, and I tell people that all the time. That's the one thing I get from John McCain. I share that with him. Say their names. Jimmy Reese. Right? Jimmy Reese said it. Front page of the Wall Street Journal. You know? And so when that happens, let that be reflective of what goes on in communities all over, the disparity between the haves and the have-nots. Now, what does that have to do with art? It was in that discussion that we found our ways to combat that. That's what Congo Square was about. We're going to find a way to combat those who have us in chains, and we're going to get out of it. We created the culture that people come from around the world to hear, that we can actually make our own economic engine out of it. That's what that Social Aid and Pleasure Club is about. That's what the Free Southern Theater was about.
Yes.
The theater company that got me into acting, that actually nurtured my vocation and love of acting. Free Southern Theater in the civil rights movement went around under the threat of violence, doing plays to support the movement. Sometimes wouldn't even come out for a curtain call, just get in the cars and split so no one could get hurt. I didn't even get to see them as a boy. Adult subject matter that my parents said, no, you can't see the play. But I would wait to see my parents turn the corner and see those headlights coming to the driveway. And I said, tell me about the play. Tell me about the play. Tell me about the play. I knew who Denise Nicholson was. I knew who John O'Neill was. They were my heroes. Gilbert Lewis. Never saw them. I always say that it's really a legacy that was handed on to me. And I also realized that if it wasn't for that resilience, if it wasn't for the rebellion, I wouldn't be here today because it was something handed to me from family.
Do it. Very short break. Coming right back. We're talking with Wendell Pierce, Bunk in the Wire, his amazing new book, The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're right here with Wendell Pierce talking about his book, The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken, about New Orleans and rebuilding New Orleans and the history of New Orleans and the power of what New Orleans is to America, the power of African-American culture and family and more, how that intermingles with arts and power. And Wendell, so when we went to break, you had a piece you wanted to read here from the book.
Yes, the connection with family and how that,
right,
that informs me today. We know who we are by the stories we tell about ourselves and the world. We know who we are through the family and community of whose stories we are a part. We make our stories, and our stories make us. I am not sure the stories in my family are art, exactly. After all, they came down to me not as objects to be admired for their beauty. Then again, they contain so much truth and goodness that they cannot help but being beautiful as well. Their trials, their triumphs, the virtues that gave them the strength to overcome, All of these things live in the stories my family shares as an inheritance that grows as we invest in it each successive generation. I draw creative strength from my roots buried deep in South Louisiana. Until the storm, I did not appreciate how much those roots were the veins connecting my heart to the body of historical experience that gave birth to the man I am today, and the man and the artist I am becoming every day. Sometime in the 1850s, nobody can say exactly when, on the banks of a Kentucky river, a boy named Ira Steele rested in the basket of his slave mother's arms as she said goodbye to their family and sailed away. One white man had sold mother and child to another white man as the child's father, brothers, and sisters stood on the water's edge in tears. 500 miles downriver, the passage of the mother and her child ended on a sugarcane plantation near Bertrandville in Assumption Parish, a moist and fertile patch of land between the Mississippi River and Bayou Lafourche. The master forced his name on the mother and child, Harris. That is how my family came to South Louisiana. Years later, after emancipation in 1865, Ira Steele would tell his children that his earliest memories are of his mother teaching him to say his prayers at night and telling him when freedom comes, as it surely would, to go on a quest. "You are not a Harris, you're a Christoph," she would say. "If you ever get free, go back to Kentucky and look for your family, the Christophs." He never did. The story of Ira Steele's descendants is a story of a parade through American history, sometimes a mournful dirge, sometimes a raucous stomp, from being symbolically owned by the bayou to owning a piece of it. That is, from being treated as no more important than the land they worked for the white man as enslaved exiles, to becoming masters of themselves and that land, which would become, in the fullest sense of the word, home. Why am I telling you this? Because I would not be the man I am if my ancestors had not been the men and women they were. In Southern culture, family and land are everything, especially to African Americans, whose families were broken by slavery and, in liberty, left with little or nothing. In my clan, the ancestors live on through the stories we tell ourselves and our children, and in the family farm on Bayou Lafourche. My cousin Nicole, the family historian, reminds us older folks that we have a responsibility to tell these family stories to the younger generation. Family can easily fall apart. You can't take it for granted. My mother and father showed me the value of family and why it's worth fighting for. Whenever I wonder why I'm hanging on to these people who are becoming strangers to me, I take a step back and think about our shared history. If we forget our stories, we will forget who we are, and we will forget who we must be to one another. The family is our strength. My personal triumphs are not mine alone. They represent the victory of all my forebears. You trace a line from the Hollywood sound stages where I work to the sugarcane fields of Louisiana's river parishes. These stories, stories of ancestors I never knew, are my story too, not only because they form the moral imaginations of those who formed me, but also because these tales from my family's oral tradition tell me who I am.
And that's a really powerful passage. And the thing about this book, Wendell, for me, is that there's so many passages like that. I did not know what to expect when I began the book. It's just, to me, the philosophy and history is, it got me almost more than the story of what's happening right now. It really did. They're connected.
You know, and that's the awakening that you have to always remember. It is the thing that can inform you as to how to go forward. It is the blueprint that has been laid out. There has been the uprising that happened in Baltimore was not the first.
Nope.
But there have been different responses to other uprisings. And there have been some that have failed. There have some that made the conditions worse. And then there are those that have improved it. And It's that connection, improved life, and improve things for everyone. And it's understanding that rich history that you have and legacy that people have that informs you how to act and how to declare your values and move forward. When I was thinking about Baltimore, I think about what happened, and I could only think about the police, but not the police who were acting in the worst way. It's the good police, as we always said on The Wire. Where are they?
Where are they?
Their outrage? Someone has disgraced your badge. Someone has disgraced your honor. When are you going to have the uprising and say, I have to declare that you are not a part of who we are? You are going to be weeded out from this honorable crew. And that's what I'm reminded of when I think about all those police officers I researched with. Black men and women who became police officers because they said that small 1% of the crime in our neighborhoods does not represent the multitude of good people in these neighborhoods who are disproportionately affected by the crime. They became police officers because they said, that doesn't represent my neighborhood, like Bunk says to Omar. You know what it was like.
Right.
You know what it was like. That's our neighborhood. No more bodies. Well, if we're going to say that as police officers, declare that we are going to change things, and that's the reason so many of them became police officers, they have to turn to their brethren and sisters in blue and say, that is not acceptable. No more bodies. You remember what it was like. This is our community. No more bodies. Say that to the police officer out of line, acting as a criminal, brutalizing innocent citizens, the way you say it to the Omars terrorizing your community. This is our neighborhood. No more bodies.
When you wrote about family, and this is so important, I think not. It's important for people to wrestle with in America about the power of family, the power of family in the black world, the power and the way you describe it of Mamo and Papo and Uncle Elsie and Dad and Mom and what they went through and what they believed and how he was a hero to you as his working class man coming home every day and wait, you waited for him so you all could sit and talk. The power of family that had history is a critical piece that we never talk about. That is so fundamental to tying to the future. You know what I'm saying? We let that get lost in where we are.
Yes. And what happens is it's also used as a pawn.
Right.
You know, I co-wrote this book with Rod Dreher. Of the American Conservative. Yeah.
That was an interesting
choice. If you look in the back, you see an acknowledgement of how we both were walking on eggshells when we met. I am this dyed-in-the-wool, blue-blooded, urban, black, progressive Obamaite. He is a rural, middle-aged white man from southern Louisiana, West Feliciana Parish, modern-day conservative, commentator and journalist, and espouser of conservative values. But we found commonality in the fact that we loved our families. We loved our culture. And this was a homecoming for me. And he had written a beautiful book about the homecoming he had when his sister was passing away, The Little Ways of Ruthie Lemming. And I ultimately said, well, he's going to, you know, it's my book, so I'm not going to let him just write anything and put in my book. You know, I'm going to work with him so that we write my book together, not his, but my book. And so I was very defensive about that, but he taught me so much about writing that was the ultimate barometer by which I judged him and asked him to work with me. But the one thing that happened was the awakening that he had, that he did not know about the struggles that so many black families had gone through right in his own community of Louisiana. He is from West Feliciana, which is kind of a hotbed of some Klan activity.
Yes, it is.
And I'll never forget when I sent him to speak with LC, my uncle, he called me and he said, you working with this guy from West Feliciana? He said, yeah. He said, you writing a book with this cat? You know, and I was like, yeah, you know where he's from, right? I was like, yes, I know. All right. Oh, boy. He just couldn't believe it. But what happened was it was an awakening. What happened in the book was, for me, was an awakening for Rod as well. And we've talked about this. He shared the book with his father on his deathbed. He wrote a beautiful piece about it in this conservative magazine. Or blog, The American Conservative, how he called it My Brothers, Black and White. He found our common humanity. We joke about it all the time because he tells me, you know, you wrote a conservative book. He's trying to make me a hero in the conservative world. You know? He said, you wrote a conservative book. You know, it's about family and, you know, the importance of family, of holding our culture. I said, you don't have the monopoly on that. I know you guys try to say it, but conservatives don't have a monopoly on understanding the importance of family and what family is and all the, that's what we've been trying to tell you all the time. Family comes in all shapes and sizes and colors, but family and what family means to you, the best connection to your past and most likely be there for you in the future, that is common to everyone. That's the thing that connects us. That's the humanity that we have with each other. That is the realm in which artists become classic. That Shakespeare, 400 years later, can speak to someone in contemporary America. This iambic pentameter, prose to verse, back and forth. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, that call for some urgency of expression in who you are, that is something that will speak long after we're gone, because it is so pure and true and authentic that it connects anyone who has any connection to humanity, any human being across time and space. 400 years from now, it'll speak to them. It's aspirational. And that's what family is. That was the awakening for me. This art that has power, this art that ties me to my legacy, this legacy that ties me to my family generations from now.
What's happened to you in writing this book and going back to New Orleans here after Katrina, you wrote when you came back in 2005, nearly 1,500 people dead, half of them in houses in the city had 4 feet of water in them or more. There was no electricity or clean water in the city. Looting and breakdown of civil order would soon follow. But you took that, helped rebuild a classic neighborhood to help people move back in to reclaim what others would have let go. But this process, you clearly, from writing this book, have connected to your history, your family's history, and I think one of the people here philosophically I really liked a lot was Albert Murray.
Absolutely.
And his philosophy of what it means to be American, seen through the eyes of the power of African-American culture and music that defines that, even though America won't admit in some ways that that is what defines us. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So this, you've discovered something here, I think, that people can wrestle
because
with.
Because ultimately that's the American aesthetic.
Right.
What people are trying to exclaim when they say, you know, the best country on earth. We are aspirational. We are a can-do country. All of that is defined in what is the American aesthetic. And American aesthetic is being able to have freedom within form, understanding that ability to find your individuality within the confines of order. So there's not chaos. And the fact that you don't have to compromise who you are and your individuality and still be honor form. And that is in an African-American aesthetic, not separate from all others' aesthetics. It's actually bringing into view the discussion in the human diaspora that makes us aspire to that great individual expressiveness where we can still honor form and law and order, but at the same time fulfill our potential as an individual. That is subscribed in the art form of jazz, where you literally have a finite amount of notes but can be put together an infinite amount of ways, that you can have a free-flowing improvisation but still know exactly where you are in the form of the tune, that you can be dissonant, that you can be harmonic, that you can have all of these different things happening at the same time but still work in conjunction with each other. And we have found a way to find the balance even in our dysfunction. These slave owners that came up with a document that could be amended for their wayward ways, they had to know someday somebody's going to figure out you can't be owning people. And you know, we got to make sure that this document is a living document, so when they see the ignorance that has lived side by side by our intellectual brilliance and a parliamentary acumen, they're going to change this document. As Barbara Jordan said, you know, the Constitution was a good document. It became a great document with the 13th, 14th Amendment, you know?
That's right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right,
so
right,
it's that
right.
Sort of balance is an American aesthetic that is embodied in the literal execution of what African-Americans can have contributed in their art, because it was a part of their experience of out of nothing. It's the metaphor of what our culinary art is in New Orleans. Scraps from the table with a little burnt oil and flour called a roux, built up in a pot in a stew that we call gumbo, that has become the envy of the world in the culinary art. Literal artistic sustenance, not only for your desire, but literally for your body. Art that actually can give you sustenance, gumbo, that actually embodies what the American aesthetic is all about. From many, one. From nothing, something. Scraps from the table, give me what you got. I'm going to find a way to make something beautiful. Out of something ugly, we made something beautiful. The mantra of Pontchartrain Park. That's an American display of the aesthetic of balance that we aspire to, that makes us different, that actually taps into our humanity with its beauty and its ugliness, knowing that you can make things better in spite of your dysfunction.
And I think that in some ways gets to the heart and sums up this incredible book. This book is more than I expected, and I recommend it to everyone to kind of grab a hold of and wrestle with the history and love and passion of who we are and what Wendell Leather tried to do and did do in New Orleans after the storm. The book is The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. And it's an American tale. And Wendell Pierce, this is a great, this really was, I'm not just BSing here. This is a great book.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
An amazing book. I just loved it.
I just want to say, I love Baltimore. And every time I talk to you, I'm reminded of how much I love Baltimore. It's sense memory. I hear your voice, and I remember being in Baltimore. And those years that I did The Wire, it became a second home. It is so closely connected to New Orleans.
Yes.
You know, a church on every corner and a bar on every other.
That's it.
And people, you know, who love their crabs, the same dysfunction, the abject poverty. But we have to realize that a rising tide floats all boats, and we share more in common than we have differences. And I just wanted to say to the people of Baltimore that, you know, I love you, hon.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.